Go there. Wait, where are we?
Good morning. I'd like to welcome everybody to the third day of our Fish and Game Commission here in Sacramento. The first day was enough, but hey, we'll stick through to the end. I'd like to make some introductions. First of all, I'm the Vice President of the Commission, Bob Hathaway, and the President of the Commission, Michael Flores, had been with us the last 2 days but couldn't be here today. So I'd like to introduce, starting on the left, my fellow Commissioner, Cindy Gustafson from Tahoe City, and then we have Commissioner Richard Rogers from Carpinteria, California, and we have Commissioner Jim Kellogg from Concord, California. Sitting right next to me here is our Executive Director, John Carlson, and then to my right, well, not anymore, but right there in the blue shirt that sits right there is our Assistant Executive Director, John Fisher. We also have our analyst, Sherry Cole. We actually have in the room, they were in the room, our Assistant Attorney General, William Cunningham, who will be sitting at the end giving us legal advice if indeed we get off track. In the back of the room is the Deputy Director of the Department, Sankey Mastrup, who will be down front any second in order to help guide us through the, you know, rocky road we have ahead. Sankey. I don't see her, but then we also have our special analyst, like whatever she's called, extraordinaire, Adriana Shea. She's not here yet, but she will be. Okay, I think I got to be. We have our game wardens, but I don't see where they are. Oh.
Captain Rob Allen.
Oh, right there. Jeez, I'm so sorry. Captain Rob Allen, right there. Thank you, warden. I know. Good. We have one guy who's real. Yesterday we had three or four, and so I was looking for them.
And he was here for about 12 hours.
Good job. We have many senior staff. I see them all over the place, but I know they'll be making presentations during the day, so I don't forget anybody. John from our staff is right there. Neil, everybody's here. But you'll probably be making. You introduce Sherry. Whatever. If I forget to introduce you, I adore you. You do good work. But you'll be talking from the microphone, so we'll move on. Today, our day isn't very busy, so we have a couple of three or four items that shouldn't take too long. And so let's get on with the show.
Thank you, Mr. Hathaway. To start with, I'd like to make an announcement that we had the president of the commission yesterday moved the item 15 was moved up to yesterday. That's receipt of public testimony on proposed amendments for migratory game birds waterfowl regulations. If anyone in the audience wants to speak on that today and give public comment, we will accept those, so turn in a speaker card. But that item was heard by the commission yesterday, but you could still give public testimony today if you turn in a card. So with that, we'll move to item 16, receipt of public recommendations and request for authorization to publish notice of intent to consider amendments of the sport fish regulations for 2007 through 2009. Please note, excuse me, rough night. The adoption hearing is scheduled for December 8th in Santa Monica. And with that, I'll turn it over to Sankey, who has assembled a large amount of staff here for this important issue.
Good morning, commissioners. I hope your evening went better than John's apparently did. I'm going to have Neil Manji do a brief overview of the department's proposals, and then we look forward to hearing any recommendations from the public.
Good morning, commissioners, commission staff, Neil Manji, Fisheries Branch Department. Today I have put together a PowerPoint. The department has canvassed its regions and other branches to determine this year's triennial recommendations from the department for sport fishing regulations, and it's pretty straightforward. We have like 120 or so. It shouldn't be bad. Just kidding. No, actually, there's only 11 proposals that the department is bringing forward, so this should go relatively quick. Once again, this is the department's proposals. What you're looking at here is the Shasta River tributary to the Klamath. I'd start off with a little photo because the rest of it gets pretty dry. The department has broken off this presentation into several categories, but we're going to try to go through them, looking at things like the general fishing regulations, then district, and then the special regulations. So under the general regulations, the first one the department is proposing is to make some modifications to the 1.63, which is the movement of live fish. God, it's kind of bouncing. Is that me? Is that that coffee?
Thank you for being so short.
Oh. Yeah. Ah, that's better.
And to the point,
yeah. Exactly. That concludes my talk.
Yeah,
there,
yeah.
6.1.63, it adds language to clarify that it's illegal to transport live fin fish any time by anybody unless otherwise authorized. Where the problem here is, talk to our enforcement is, historically, or the current regulations talk about, if you are a license holder, is illegal to transport live fish. And what we're trying to do is just get that it's for anybody to transport live fish, it's going to be illegal, and remove the reference to a sport angler with a license. The second one is the native reptiles and amphibians in section 1.7. It revises the definition to include all specimens regardless of their origin. There's a lot of areas where this will clarify interpretation or issues by eliminating origin as a consideration for what specimens would not be considered native. We have a lot of native specimens that are being reared in, I was going to say hatchery situations, but in private industry, and we still have to have regulations to do that. So now, although they're of native origin, it doesn't matter just as long as they're indigenous to the state. The last one on general fishing regulations is section 2.0. This one, your Deputy Attorney General, Mr. Cunningham, has brought to my attention that may need some work. We were trying to, with enforcement, add some language to be able to enforce more of a snagging, illegal take. So we were adding specific language that clearly states it's illegal to kill or retain a fish that did not actively take the bait or lure in its mouth and requires the fish to be released immediately. We're going to try to work a little bit more with this particular one with Mr. Cunningham, commission staff, and enforcement, because there has been some concern just brought up today that we may not be making it that much more clear in terms of being able to enforce that. And there are some other states that have a fairly good definition of snagging. We might consider putting that in. So that was something new that was just brought up.
Neil, before you get off that slide, if I may.
Sure.
Going back up to 1.63.
Yes.
Transportation is defined as what?
Well,
in this case, the reason I'm asking, let me give you the context. The reason I'm asking you this is a lot of people will, for example, in a bass boat, put live bass in a well,
right.
A live well, or on an offshore boat. Sometimes you'll put your whatever it is in the bait tank.
Right.
Is that illegal?
Most time, no. Now,
well, how are we going to?
Well, no. Yeah. Once you trailer your boat, that it becomes illegal. So I brought up the same questions. For example, I like to use San Francisco Bay. If for one reason you want to collect your bait in South San Francisco, and you want to go early in the morning, but you really want to fish North San Francisco, it would be illegal to go to South San Francisco in your vehicle, towing your boat, go off a pier, get shiner surf perch for bait, and then put it in your live well in your boat, and then transport to north, and then launch your boat. It would not be illegal if you just put in North Bay or South Bay and got your bait and drove all the way within the same body of water.
Okay. Will 1.63 actually have enough language in it so that people can understand that's true?
Good
point. As you read it, you know, guys with live wells are going to go, wait a minute. Because offshore, people put what they've got in their bait all the time.
We definitely do not want to eliminate current practices right now that defines, you know, being able to transport bait to fish. And the same thing with in freshwater. You go to a bait dealer and get minnows. You obviously have to transport those minnows to a location. But
as you know, it's not only just bait. I mean, a lot of guys will catch a cabazon or whatever and put it in the bait well.
Right. Oh, right, right. And keep it for
and keep it fresh for the rest of the day. And then when they come in, they go ahead.
Yeah, that's not considered transporting live fish because it's not transporting it from another body of water.
I see. So. Okay.
And
we need to make sure that people don't get confused and Western Outdoor News doesn't go nuts as they often do, uninformed.
Right. Thank you. And that is a good point. We will make sure that is clarified.
And Neil, I would hope that snagging's the issue we're trying to address here. That we can come up with some language that actually says that instead of, because there's a lot of people that, you know, we put fancy language in there trying to protect all the stuff, and I think we need to include the word snagging in there so people know what the heck we're talking about.
Yeah, I agree with that, Jim.
Yeah, I think we hear you loud and clear. We'll definitely go back and try to draft something that is a little bit clear.
Hand the written draft to someone who has no idea about fishing regulations and ask them what it says.
You know, matter of fact, I do that to an extent quite a bit.
Yeah, like get a hand it to your kids and say, what do you think is legal here and what is not legal? And if it passes that test, we're probably cool.
Yeah, but most of our fishermen are smarter than 7-year-olds, so I do want to say that, even though yours is very smart. So
God, what a patronizing comment.
Well, hand it to your kids. How about just hand it to someone on a boat?
The next group is dealing with black bass fishing and or some special regs in 7.50. We have four regs, regulation proposals here. They're all embedded in one initial statement. When I said we had 11 regulations, we have 11 rulemaking packages or initial statements, and some of them are combined for ease and of reading so you don't have so many documents to go through. The first one in the black bass would close the streams in southwest Inyo County and all of Mono County in waters not listed in 7.50 to black bass fishing when the trout season is also closed. The main purpose for this is that individuals are fishing in some prime trout areas during the and going under the regulations of 5.0, which allows black bass anglers to fish in those areas. What we want to do is maintain that trout fishery there and not have those fish being subject to catch and release. So if they are black bass fishing, those regulations will go to the general regs, which is last Saturday in April, mostly to November 15th. The second one here, remove Haywee Reservoir from 5.0 and 7.50. Haywee Reservoir is a reservoir on the east side of 395 down by Independence. LA Water is currently going to try to close that off to fishing, and it would be very confusing that we have the special regs in there. So it will just remove Haywee from 5.0, and therefore it automatically will go into the district regulations for that area. There's still, I believe, some public access, but they're trying to. It's a issue of security, national security, water, reservoir, things like that. So they would like to close that. They had it closed for several years, and they reopened it. And that's when we wanted to protect the fishery. So we'll go back to the general season, which is still last Saturday in April. Removes Big Lake from the Shasta County Black Bass Regulation and place in individual bodies of water open from last Saturday in April through November 15th. This, again, this one's up in Northern California. It's a lake that we had a contradiction in our regulations. Under 5.00, which is the bass, we had this open up all year, or in the general regs, we had it opened up all year. But also, in the general regs, we had the waters of Fall River Valley closed and only opened during the last Saturday in April through November 15th. So once again, a lot of individuals were fishing Big Lake during the winter times when, in fact, it was closed, because when waters are closed to trout and salmon, they're closed to all fishing. So we had a contradiction. I believe there will be some testimony on that today, and a biologist from Northern California is here to speak about the specifics on that. The last one is a simple one, revised name of Sage Reservoir to Big Sage Reservoir. It's known in Northern California as Big Sage Reservoir. District general fishing regulations, north, central, southern districts. We want to clarify what tidal influence waters in the north central district are open to fishing. If one were to read this right now, it just basically says, you know, tidal waters in the north central district are closed to fishing, when in fact there are other areas, that's the Petaluma River, some places in San Francisco Bay, that if the reader was referred to section 1.53 and 27.00, they would know that these areas are open, and it makes it very confusing. So we're just adding some language in there to refer the reader to these other sections, with the exceptions where tidal fishing is still allowed. There was some confusion there, and it will help out enforcement also. This one kind of fits in just the district generals to an extent. This one would close a Ventura River from the Robles diversion to the base of Matilla Dam on the Matilla Creek and to the Wheeler Gorge Campground on the North Fork of the Matilla Creek. This change would result in approximately 4 miles of stream protection of southern steelhead. What we have here is an area that we spent, not the department, but the Bureau of Reclamation and individuals that operate the Casitas water has put in a tremendous fish ladder. And now there's fish passage for anadromous fish in the Ventura River there. And historically, they were not able to get over Robles Dam. Now they're able to get through that dam. And they are now then stopped at the other areas, which are barriers to anadromy. So we will be asking you to protect those areas of the stream.
Neil, if I may.
Oh.
Go back. You mean you want to close it to all forms of fishing, not just no steelhead?
Correct. Fishing. All forms of fishing in that those areas. Yeah, close to fishing. Basically, those fish that are migrating up there are potentially steelhead, and the offspring that even the resident fish in there potentially in the next year or two could decide to go down into the ocean. So it would be closed to all fishing.
So what was the rainbow population up there? Is there much of one? Are you aware of that?
Maybe Dave could help me on that one.
Is the idea here that they may, you know, throw a switch internally and become steelhead? Is that what's going on here? Or that somebody couldn't differentiate between a steelhead and a rainbow, so therefore?
Pretty much all of the above. They do have steelhead going in there, so the juvenile offspring, which may have a year or two-year life cycle there, could be
look like
that.
Rainbows.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And on top of that, some of the resident fish there, studies have shown that have decided to go out after 3-4 years sometimes.
Right.
So.
Okay, thank you.
If you didn't hear that, Dave,
Dave
was talking about it makes it consistent with the other steelhead waters in that area also in Southern California where they are closed to fishing all year. These now we're jumping into Section 7.50 Special Fishing Regs, Battle Creek. Historically, we had an area open for one hatchery steelhead above the Coleman National Fish Hatchery. We would like to say zero fish now because there is going to be a barrier above Coleman National Fish Hatchery that will not allow any fish above the hatchery other than wild fish. So we're asking the commission to close that, similar to the Ventura, where we're going to get some access to wild fish now. Or at least zero fish, not actually closing it. Barren Deep Creek, which is down in Southern California, we will remove the existing 8-inch. I know you're happy about that, trying to remove regulations. Basically, we've determined that the 8-inch minimum size limit will have no effect on the fish populations, and they weren't having the effect that we thought they were going to have. So we'd ask you to repeal that. Eel River fishing regulations. This one was fairly simple. It would describe sections of the Van Dusen River consistent in all regulations. We refer to the eel in two areas, a low flow closure and just the general fishing, and the sections of the Van Dusen are not exactly the same in both regulations, so we want to clarify that. The Merced fishing area, this one's another fairly simple one. Current regulations on Merced and Stanislaus County refer to the Schaefer Bridge on Montpelier Road. In Merced County, the name of the same road becomes Oakdale. So, well, depending on where you live, they know it as Montpelier or Oakdale. It's been an enforcement issue, so we're going to change everything to the Schaefer Bridge on Oakdale Road. Another clarification, 7.50, is Smith River fishing. This is just to help the angler identify and realize that the yearly bag limit for wild steelhead on the Smith River is a total of 5 fish. The way it's worded now, one can interpret that they get 5 wild steelhead on each fork of the Smith, but we'll make it very clear that it's only 5 per year. Sierra District trout catch and release, winter trout fishing. As you know, a few years back, the commission adopted a open all year on the Upper Sacramento River. In your Reading meeting, the department's planning on giving a presentation on the Upper Sac and how well that went. Since then, the department's been waiting to the triennial process to incorporate additional waters in there. It's an additional 10 waters, and you can see them in light blue there. Those are the ones that are identified, the areas are identified in your initial statements. With those changes, for example, on Tuolumne and North Fork Yuba, there are also additional regulations that we are going to, I saw Mr. Kellogg smile, we're also going to ask you to repeal because they were very similar to Deep Creek. They aren't really doing what we thought they were supposed to do, so we'll simplify the regulations by taking off the minimum size limit on both those waters and making sure that we are consistent in a larger stretch of water there.
Neil, thank you for those changes, especially on the Truckee River. I heard a lot about that when I was speaking with the fly fishing club up there.
I know. Okay. Now, what's everybody dear into everybody's hearts, the sturgeon fishing regulations. And what I'd first like to start off by explaining is that, you know, the commission took action to implement emergency regulations, and at which time you asked the department to go back and talk to the constituents and try to come to some agreement on what would be a good fix for sturgeon fishing. And we did that. We went and listened to the commission and has had approximately, I believe, 5 public meetings. One needs to go as we go through this. This is not an exact science. I think you've heard from quite a few people about the department's lack of information, and some anglers such as Mr. Kellogg and had some excellent days out there, Mr. Flores, things like that. We also referred to the Oregon and Washington regulations to get some kind of help because they have been managing these sturgeon for a while. One also has to remember that as we go into this, this is going to give us a much better baseline data. So some of the skeptics, which is even within the department, that we understand, we fully realize that the data is lacking, will give us a better baseline. The one thing also, as I go through this, you'll notice that there will be some new requirements regarding some of the things that anglers that have historically not had to go through, meaning anglers under 16 years of age and anglers fishing piers and jetties, but I'll get to that briefly. So as it currently stands, the department is proposing the size limit for white sturgeon from 46 to 60. It was 46 to 72. The emergency was 46 to 56, and now we're going to 46 to 60. There would be continuing no take. Right now there's a take of 1 green sturgeon. We would maintain the try to maintain the emergency portion of the no take of of green sturgeon. The daily bag limit of one white sturgeon would be the same. The annual bag limit of three white sturgeon. And how we would do that is the last one with the annual sturgeon report cards. But before that, one thing that we, like I said, we'd have to identify is boat limits would not apply when sturgeon fishing in ocean waters. There is some of that that still occurs. So I know the commission took action about boat limits, but that would make it an enforcement nightmare pretty much.
Is this the report card?
Okay. Yeah, this
could
is.
Could you go through that procedure?
Yeah, this is. We'll go through that procedure a little bit. This is just a first or second cut at a report card, based on some other abalone steelhead report cards. We're trying to cost it out. How much it would cost to print these? How we'd get them out? So here's basically what you're looking at: the information of released fish, the lower areas down here. Are where the tags would be taken off and applied to sturgeon. And like I said, I could get a copy of this for you if you'd like to see it, but we're still working on to make sure we're trying to make as bulletproof as we can.
So in other words, every sturgeon that's in the boat has to have a tag clipped to it?
If it's definitely retained, yes.
Right.
Every white sturgeon.
Right.
And we'll go that. Sturgeon fishing report card. Any person fishing for sturgeon will be required to have a sturgeon fishing report card, and only one card per person calendar year may be purchased. That's pretty standard. Here's where the commission is going to have to consider. This includes anglers who are under 16 years of age, anglers who are fishing from a public pier, and anglers who hold a lifetime fishing license. Obviously, anglers fishing under 16 may purchase a sturgeon report card without purchasing a sport fishing license. We have had a lot of discussion internally about this, and as you know right now with the abalone, salmon punch card, and other steel report card, if you don't have a license, you aren't required to have one of these punch cards. We felt rather than come to the commission with trying to change the abalone, the salmon punch card, and the steel report card, that we would go with this as a pilot project to determine whether the commission would be favorable of requiring anglers under the age of 16 years to get that. And the main purpose of that is through some of our surf sampling is we are missing quite a few anglers out there, and some information that's very, very valuable. And in sturgeon, any additional information will help. So, and as ALDS, the automated license sales, comes on, we may be able to streamline this even better.
You know, also, Neil, if I remember correctly, during some of the hearings that we had here, some people who came here to speak about sturgeon, I think there was some suggestion that there were kids involved in the boats and that this was something. That would be a real enforcement nightmare if you had, oh, no, my kid caught it, you know, type problem.
Right, and that's right, exactly. So that was it. And the enforcement nightmare and also the biological information. I mean, we want those juveniles. They catch a lot of fish, too. Are they under 16? So we really want
the ones I know sure do.
Oh, yeah.
Darn good at it.
Then going on the report card, also, whenever the cardholder catches a sturgeon, whether the fish is retained or released, the cardholder shall immediately record the sturgeon on the sturgeon fishing report card the month, day, catch, location, species of sturgeon.
Neil, I got a question on that. Is that you're talking about whether it's caught or released? Is that just referring to sturgeon that are in the slot limit?
No, that's all sturgeon, because that's what we really need to know is how many are being caught. It's not necessarily long line release. Ooh, you know, but you know, near the boat, we know that individuals that are too small, they're just going to shake them off at the boat. But what we need to know is that so many fish below were released and be able to identify whether how many were actually kept of those.
Okay, but that won't apply to their annual three.
No. Catch and release all you want.
Yeah, good. Because right now me and Florida are equal. We both got sturgeon in the slot limit, and I released mine, and he ate his.
For the record.
For the rest of the commissioners.
For the record, yeah. You know, is there any way I read the press quite a bit about all this stuff, and one of the comments that were lot of the negative comments about what we're trying to do with sturgeon had to do with there's gazillions of sturgeon out there.
Right.
Can you envision a scenario where once we, let's say we put this in place, put the report card in place, the guy catches and lands one sturgeon and puts, oh, by the way, I caught and released 57 when he didn't.
Yeah, we see a little bit of that in our wild trout self-reporting, you know, boxes. I think there's going to be some time that we'll have to look through that and be able to try to decipher some of the people are just toying with us to an extent.
Well, to their own vested interest, to inflate the population statistics so that you won't get the idea that there's a problem.
There's always that possibility, but you know, like I say, on a daily basis, you know, a guy punches in that many, it's going to be pretty hard. But you're right. Over time, you know, it's just like one each day. That's an issue. That's the problem a lot of times with a lot of our self-imposed reporting. But what we do have that we've looked at with the wild trout is done creel census, which we will have on the Delta and Sacramento to kind of coincide on those same days and be able to say, oh, I don't believe that, you know, this was correct for that particular day. So we'll have a little bit of ability to check and check that. Okay, sturgeon tagging requirements. A sturgeon fishing report card includes three tags, like I stated earlier, and that are to be used to tag any white sturgeon that is retained. After retaining a white sturgeon, the date, location, and length of fish shall be immediately recorded. The angler shall immediately attach a tag to the body of the white sturgeon and leave the tag in place until Mr. Flores cuts it and processes and stakes and eats it. So... very similar regulations on other species, abalone, things like that. Well, that concludes my presentation for today. Those are all the department's proposed regulations. We do have approximately 50 to 60 public proposals that we will be responding to and providing that in the rulemaking packages. I think we've got about 30 of them already processed and about another 20 or 30 that are online. We fully anticipate, now that this is out and we're having discussion hearings, that we'll hear from a lot of the public and we'll be acting on that as quickly as possible to get you updates.
Another question for you, if I may. Sure. Back to sturgeon, don't move the slides. On the report card, what sort of pricing on this are you thinking about?
Good point. We've got, right now, without legislation, we could recover our cost to produce this card, and I think Sonke, check me if I'm wrong, but we have about a $0 to $7.50.
Correct.
And from that, we know based on 50,000 of these things, something like that, that it might cost us upwards of about $30,000, $40,000 just to produce the card and send them out to licensed agents. Now, that doesn't include the cost of actually looking at the cards and using that to determine, you know, help us with basically what the cards are designed for is biological information and also enforcement. What we have presented to, for example, the Bay Delta, planted the seed with the Bay Delta enhancement stamp where everybody has to fish in the Bay Delta or down from these dams are required to pay $5. We have brought it up to the Bay Delta Stamp Committee that to plant the seed, that we may ask them to take on a portion of those costs. I think it's very difficult to get in front of and the support of the anglers to go in front of them and say, the sturgeon anglers, oh, by the way, you're going to pay $33 for a license, $5 for a Bay Delta stamp, and on top of that, another $3 to $5, let's say, to purchase a sturgeon report card. So we're trying to see of different alternatives to get that cost and that information without having to tap into the angler that's, you know, already paying for two licenses basically to fish, you know, in the Delta or below where sturgeon are actively caught.
Having said that, we don't want any increased burdens on the department, which is obviously already stretched. And I would suspect that while there may be some anglers who would squeal, it's probably the same angler who a couple of days before paid $250 for a lovely, right, Shimano reel. So I'm not, you know, not certain whether our recovering our costs is not such a bad idea.
Yeah, and I think it's important to emphasize we have put this in the lap of the Bay Delta Enhancement Advisory Committee, and we've specifically asked them to underwrite the startup here. In this case, we're really worried right now about recovering costs of production and distribution of the card itself. Recognize that we're going to learn information, and we're going to start doing some activities, but based on that information, we may ramp up more research and things like that, or outreach, in which case that's why the range is there. And until we find out whether they're going to underwrite or be willing to underwrite this, we're hoping not to charge now, but we may want to recover a minor administrative fee. That doesn't mean down the future, if, for example, the data suggests we need to do a lot more extensive surveys, fishery independent surveys, we may come back and ask for a higher fee to cover those costs. But that's something we'll learn, and using Wednesday's terminology, we're going to have to be adaptive on this thing.
Yeah, I agree, and it strikes me that the cost of this is really important to the viability of the population. I mean, you're going to end up with information that may release the size limits, may release the number of people, the number of fish that can be taken in a year or in a day, but without the information, it's very difficult, you know, to have that. So I think most enlightened anglers would be very interested in participating in the program, because it should, if in fact there is no problem with the fishery, as they assert, this will prove that, and they should be released from their problems.
It definitely will help quite a bit, and like I say, I think this commission has heard a lot of testimony and a lot from the department that we are lacking some information. We don't disagree with some of the public, but I think this will be a big step in gaining some of this information, other than, you know, what we've been doing in the past, which is still going to be occurring to an extent. Some angler creels and things like that, same trawls, things, and the party boat, you know, guide logs, things like that. That will all be used.
Good job, Neil.
Cindy?
Neil, I just had a quick question. In May, we took action on the Silver King Creek. Do you have any results report on how things went there this summer, or have?
I don't. OAL has a final statement of that, so it's gone forward.
And then, is that closure? Is that emergency action reflected in these regs? Does that continue on?
It's not reflected on these because you already took action. They're already in OAL.
So it's already there.
It's already done deal. Yeah, done deal. So I don't know if anybody, Dave, are you aware of how things have occurred, I mean, in terms of the Packers, things like that? Are they jumping for joy and up there fishing?
I haven't heard any fishing reports yet. That's you.
Hopefully
I'm more interested
utilizing
in the Packers' cooperation, because that was a lot of the testimony we heard, that he would be assisting and helping monitor what was happening out there for that closure, and that's why we reduced the size of what the department recommended. So.
Right.
I'd really be disappointed if we didn't get good feedback from those guys, because they made a lot of protestations that they would participate and they would help us and they would be eyes on the stream.
Yeah, part of that may be that the department hasn't sought that information yet. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure when I've talked to those individuals, they have been very, you know, we'll do whatever we can. You need to get it on our packs, get up there, take a look. And that's one area that I have personally not seen. So I may take them up on that to get up there.
Well, given the intensity of the department's presentation to us as to the need, I would presume you would go talk to them.
Exactly. Sankey, can I make that happen?
Yeah. Thank you. Okay.
August.
Great.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any more questions? Thank you, Neil. I think we have some public testimony. Oh, Marcy's standing there. I'm so sorry. A tag team we have.
Good morning. Marcy Aramco with the department's marine region, and I just want to provide you four additional proposals that the department has prepared for the marine portion of the regulations.
Thank you.
First, these changes are separate from the ones that you'll be considering in your next agenda item relative to recreational groundfish fishing. There are two different packages because the regulations for sport groundfish, which Maria will be discussing next, have to be effective by January 1. So the triennial process Those regs will become effective in March, actually, and so as a result, we have them broken out separately. So we only have four in this section, but you'll be hearing about the rest in a minute. The first of the four changes would clarify in the regulations that there is no limit on jumbo squid. Right now, there's a bit of confusion because the section is very general and it just says squid. And so we've had a lot of calls and enforcement's had a lot of calls about what the bag limit is for jumbo squid, the bigger squid. So we just want to make a clarifying change to the language so that anglers know that there is no limit on either species of squid. The second change would eliminate a 32-inch minimum size limit that we have right now for Pacific halibut. And the reason we are proposing to eliminate the size limit is because the International Pacific Halibut Commission recently took action for federal waters to eliminate the size limit. So we don't want to have two rules on the books that are different outside of state waters and inside of state waters. So we're just making our changes to our rules for consistency. Also, it'll provide another month of fishing opportunity for these species and increase the season length from May through October. Right now, it's only through September. The third change would make a very minor clarifying change to the existing regulations for divers relative to the take of lobster. The existing language in one place is a little bit fuzzy and could possibly be misunderstood. And so we want to be very clear that anglers must take lobster only by hand. They may not use spears or mops or any other device to assist them. So it's just a very minor clarifying change. And the fourth change would eliminate the existing requirement that all brown-skinned rockfish fillets be a minimum of 6.5 inches in length. This regulation is no longer necessary based on some other changes we've made to the groundfish regs, and so this provision is no longer needed, and it's causing a fair amount of confusion for the public because they don't know what a, quote, brown-skinned rockfish is. We haven't defined those species. So eliminating that provision will make it a lot more clear for the public. So that's it for the triennial portion, and again, you'll be hearing the rest from Maria later.
Thank you, Marcy. Any questions? Let's move to public testimony.
Yes, and I forgot to mention earlier this morning, if anyone in the audience is interested in making a public comments on any of the items on the agenda today, please turn in a green speaker card. They're on the table. Are they in the hallway, Sherry? They're on the table in the hallway. So we have seven cards for this item, and I don't have any speaker cards for any other items yet today. So if you're interested, please turn those in up either here to Sherry or to John Fisher. First speaker on fishery on item 16 today, and this will give 3 minutes apiece for public speaking. Doug Lavelle, followed by Tom Raftikin, followed by Dave Teeswee.
I'm Doug Lovell. I'm here to talk about a proposed change to the regulations for striped bass, specifically proposing a slot limit of 17 to 30 inches in contrast to existing regulations, which are a minimum of 18 inches. I'm a civil engineer, tackle shop owner, and fishing guide. Last time I spoke before the commission was in support of the Bay Delta Sport Fishing Enhancement Stamp. And I and my colleagues were some of the primary authors for that legislation. We've been strong supporters of conservation in the Bay Delta and particularly for striped bass for the past decades. In October and November, we will present to the commission further information regarding the rationale and endorsements about these regulations or about the proposed regulation changes, and I thought I'd just introduce it to you today. Striped bass fishing in the San Francisco Bay Delta Estuary has a rich and storied history. Many authors have claimed it's California's premier recreational fishery, but it's been a fishery in trouble for a number of years. Starting in the 50s and 60s, it became endangered primarily due to the export pumps in the South Delta. And then most recently, as a result of the serious troubles in the delta ecosystem, otherwise known as the pelagic organism decline, the striped bass fishery is in serious trouble. As you're probably aware, many species in the delta are seeing historic lows since the turn of the century. Over the past several years, indices for delta smelt have been at their historic lows, and also for young of the year striped bass. So it portends that we've got a serious problem facing us with respect to the striped bass and its recreational fishery. In the 80s, the Fish and Game Commission passed a policy regarding striped bass, and in a nutshell, it summarizes a short-term target abundance of about 1.1 million striped bass and long-term abundance of a little over 3 million striped bass. And that policy was subject to considerations of striped bass predation on native salmonids and delta smelt. As I indicated, the existing regulation is two fish with an 18-inch minimum, and our proposal is for 17 to 30-inch slots, so all fish less than 17 and all fish greater than 30-inch would need to be released. However, the two fish harvest would still remain in place. Based on Department of Fish and Game modeling, their spreadsheet model, the proposed slot has a similar overall abundance for the slot compared to the existing regulations. In other words, the total abundance of striped bass would be similar under the proposed slot. However, the size distribution would be significantly different. It would be biased more towards the larger year classes or the larger fish, and we would have greater harvest in the 17 to 18 inch range with the new regulations. The proposed slot provides a reservoir of large spawning fecund females, which bode well for the sustainability, self-sustaining nature of this fishery. As you probably are aware, most large striped bass are indeed females, and the fecundity of a striped bass increases almost exponentially as it gets greater. A barely mature female striped bass, about 16 inches or 5 pounds, you know, produces several thousand eggs, whereas a fully mature large female striped bass produces several million eggs. So the slot limit provides a reservoir of large fecund female striped bass, which help ensure the sustainability of the recreational fishery. Lowering the minimum size limit from 18 to 17 inches provides a greater opportunity for angler harvest and accordingly greater angler satisfaction. Also, lowering the size limit and harvesting more of the 17 to 18 inch striped bass will reduce predation on threatened and endangered salmonids and delta smelt. The prime predation size for striped bass on these, albeit small in general, is in that lower size class range. In other words, a 17-inch striped bass is a much more voracious predator on salmon and steelhead smolts and delta smelt than a 30-inch striped bass. In addition, more larger fish in general produces a greater angler satisfaction for catch and release catch and release fishing. Enforcement issues are, in fact, although there's going to be a startup period with respect to any change in regulations, it certainly is easier to spot at long distance someone harvesting a 30-inch plus striped bass than it is to try and figure out whether they're harvesting more than one or two. Or more than two 18-inch striped
bass. Thank you. The 3 minutes is up. If you could please wrap it up.
I've just got two more points to cover. The striped bass sampling in terms of its mercury and PCB content have shown that striped bass in excess of 27 inches are unhealthy for sensitive populations to eat, and that includes pregnant women, nursing women, and children. And striped bass in excess of 35 inches are unhealthy to eat for any healthy adult. And so the slot limit actually provides a better human health incentive to harvest smaller striped bass, which are not as toxic to eat. So the slot limit appears to be a winner from a sustainability perspective for the striped bass, from an endangered species predation standpoint, from the angler satisfaction standpoint, and from a human health standpoint. And take any questions or provide you further information.
I want to clarify who you are and where this information came from. I'm curious.
Is this your
personal opinion or just something that's been studied? And
this is something that's been studied, and again, in October and November, we're going to lay out the endorsements for this and a lot more of the background on how we developed. We considered a variety of various changes to the angling regulations in response to this pending crash in the fishery, and we'll lay that out in more detail with quite a number of speakers.
Yeah, okay. Then the other part of my question is, you're saying who are you representing?
At this point in time, I'm representing Doug Lovell as an individual angler. And again, endorsements will come forward in October and November.
Okay. If I may, too. Thank you, Commissioner Kellogg, for asking a question. That was going to be one of my questions, too. Also, Neil, when this comes in later on with your information and the veracity of the information pointed out, yesterday we heard a lot about the crisis in the Delta, the pelagic organisms, etc., and the impacts on the Delta are profound in this regard. And one of the things that the department, I'm sure, would not want to find itself a position that it would not want to find itself in would be to promoting the a population of a non-native voracious feeder on native fish in the Delta, all due respects to the fishery, and I rather enjoy catching striped bass. The point of the matter here is that there are profound economic impacts on a native fish population problem in the Delta. If this in any way makes that worse, the department's going to need to understand that thoroughly. And I'm going to need to understand that when these regulations come forward.
I think I appreciate that comment, and I think that's why the slot limit was lowered from 18 to 17, because it actually reduces the predation on those special
stations. Once again, as Commissioner Kellogg said, I would love to see that documented. That would be a very pleasant event if that were to occur.
I wanted to introduce it today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next speaker, Tom Raftikin, followed by David Teasley, looks like Teasley, and then Ken Jensen.
Good morning. Tom Raftikin, President of United Anglers of Southern California. We've got several recommendations for the upcoming sport fishing regulations. These deal with, in the marine region, albacore and bluefin tuna. We're asking that we impose a limit on the catch of albacore and bluefin tuna. 10 fish would fall in line with their similar bag limits. It's actually twice what the Mexican limits are, and there currently are no limits on those fisheries right now. I think when you start looking at what's going on the national and international level, these are fisheries that are essentially at risk. There's going to be action on them in the future, and it's when you look in terms of other nations, if they point to California, California has no recreational limit on their take, it sends the wrong sign nationally and internationally. Thresher and Mako sharks, we ask that you impose a change the bag limit from 2 fish per day to a single fish per day. These are large animals. Southern California Bite serves as a nursery ground for both thresher and mako sharks, and we really need to start looking seriously at ensuring a future for these very valuable fish. And the third area that we're asking for is kelp bass or calico bass. This is one of the prime recreational sport fishing fish, particularly in Southern California. We ask that a slot limit be placed on these bass. The slot limit that we're initially proposing would be 12 to 18 inches. We're also asking that the bag limit be reduced from 10 fish per day to 5 fish per day. We're trying to get some work done right now on the fecundity and looking at how much more productive the larger bass are, but this really is not about producing more fish. We've got a robust fishery right now, but Berkeley did a study a number of years ago, and they asked, why do people fish? And they went over, you know, travel for the fish and catching a lot of fish and fish for the table. They found out that the number one reason that people fish is to catch big fish. And what this is this is following the lead of Florida and some other states. Actually, if you look at redfish populations from the Carolinas all the way around through Florida and into the Gulf, they've expanded along with the take of large fish. You'll also notice that there's an increase in license sales in those same areas. People fish for large fish, and it's about time that instead of simply managing for a lot of fish, that we take the lead here and start looking, find ways to get big fish out there. It's a better balanced population, and the thing is, it's time that we took the lead on this instead of having it drugged to us later on down the line where scientists say, hey, you're going to have to do something to change this. Thank you.
Tom, I think that's great. And Sonke, maybe you and Gary Stacy can take a look at their proposal. I mean, here's a fishery group coming in suggestion that we make some changes in cutting down on the amount of fish caught.
So is the commission at large then recommending to add that proposal?
No, to get with the United Anglers and
oh, sure. I mean, we...
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Just take a look at what their suggestion and come back to us with the recommendation based on some of their suggestions. This is what I was asking you and Gary to do.
Just right, making sure I understood.
Yeah, Commissioner Keller, I too am absolutely behind what you just said. We keep
talking about the constituent groups have to weigh in and start helping us solve some of these problems. Here's a group that's doing that, and I'm saying let's take advantage of it.
Absolutely. Tom, if I may, question. Mm-hmm. We all know that Mexican waters are within a heartbeat of San Diego. We all know that the vast majority of bluefin taken in California and albacore taken in California are in boats out of San Diego. How would you envision this 10 per day relating to landings in San Diego on the party boats, et cetera?
Well, if these boats are fishing, they're actually finally starting to get a little bit better looking at this, whether it's fishing in Mexican waters or California waters. As I understand it, they're starting to do a better job of ensuring that we actually have California licenses on the boats. Now, these are, again, as I understand it, internal to the sport fishing fleet out of San Diego. But the thing is, this limit really is much more generous than the Mexican limit. But I think the days, you know, that we're looking at between TSA and a number of things, it's going to be pretty clear the areas that these boats are fishing. And, you know, the enforcement for California is actually going to be easier because the limits would be more generous. So I don't think it makes anything more confusing to the Department of Fish and Game. If you're caught in Mexican waters, you better be on the Mexican limit. You come back, right now there is no limit at all. So, what we're doing is simply capping effort. And what we try to do is set it at a reasonable amount. That this is, we've talked to an extensive amount of people on this.
Yeah,
we've done the surveys on the Calico Bass with our own members through our newsletter and website. There's a great deal of support on each one of these issues.
Tom, I got it. And you and Commissioner Rogers would understand this probably, but because I've never fished for tuna, every time I've been invited, they're talking to me about going out 60, 80 miles out, and you know the waters that we're talking about regulating are 3 miles out. Do we actually catch them?
They're precious few tuna and albacore ever caught inside of 3 miles.
Sonke has a comment.
Yeah, I was going to recommend Maria Vojkovic is our state rep on the council, which is dealing with this issue from their jurisdiction, and it's kind of a complicated issue. And I think it'd be wise to have Maria kind of give you a little bit of context of this issue from that point of view, so you understand what we're working with.
She's okay. Standing yeah. Behind
Maria.
You, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
Okay. Yeah, we have Maria and a NOAA fisheries guy here, but
This is good public information. Please,
good morning,
Maria.
Commissioners. Maria Vojkovic with the Marine Region. The Pacific Fishery Management Council has a highly migratory species fishery management plan, which contains the tunas and the sharks. These particular issues that Mr. Raptkin is speaking about have been voiced in the council arena and have been given as an assignment to the management team to consider for bringing to the council for consideration of adoption. So the team is working on this issue currently for this 2000 year of what kind of management changes might be necessary. So if the council chooses to go with a bag limit for the tunas, they're kind of leaning that way. Oregon has them. Washington has expressed an interest in putting some type of bag limit on. Then we would just simply conform to those federal regulations after that fact so that the discussion doesn't take place in both places, I mean, two places at different times. So that would be my suggestion relative to the tunas. For the shark issue, we have very little data to even contemplate whether this is an issue or not at this point. And so we're on alert. We're looking at how we might collect some of that information to be able to make an assessment of whether there is anything necessary to be done for the thresher shark issue.
Or the Mako.
Or Makos.
Especially since a 10:59 all tackle record was just caught off Anacapa, 2 weeks ago?
Yes. And those big fish do come through for a very short period of time every year. We do have, through the council, an annual OY set for the sharks, or the combination of both commercial and sport. So we do have a cap on the amount of sharks that can be taken already. So this issue has been discussed in that arena. The team has looked at it, and they're continuing to find out where they might find some data to be able to assess what the issue might be with those sharks.
To what extent does the Mexican government cooperate in this or stay connected with this?
It's very difficult. Most of the discussions, and maybe my federal partner can talk about that, but most of the discussions between the governments take place at the State Department level. We have some interactions with biologists on a few issues like coastal pelagic sardines. We have a forum that Mexican biologists meet with us. There's really very little opportunity on a government-to-government basis at this point for fisheries issues.
Is that something of concern to the Fed? I'd love to hear from the Feds about
this.
We've asked
for information from Mexico. I mean, a lot of the stocks are shared, and we have
Absolutely.
Management plans. We can't even get landings to know where we are in our catches for both countries. Very difficult. It's been a challenge for many years. And California takes every opportunity when we talk to NIMS in their ability to speak to those scientists through the national level to bring our issues up.
Commissioners?
Thank you.
In that vein, there is a triennial meeting held at the federal level between the U.S. government, Mexico, and Canada on a whole bunch of resource issues. The department has attended those, and they just recently had one in San Diego where several of the department staff attended to address some of these issues. I happen to focus on avian influenza because obviously that affects the continent. But then the other is trying to establish improved working relationship, primarily just to share information more effectively between the governments. And I don't know if our federal representative here can address that, but that's something we all recognize, and I know personally the Mexican government's very interested in collaborating more. It's just there are some boundaries that we have to deal with in terms of the way they organize in their ideas of sharing information and ours is just syncing them.
Sure. Mr. Strzok, not to put you on the spot, but if you have anything to add to this, we welcome you to the microphone.
Thank you.
Is the assistant administrator of NOAA Fisheries here?
Unfortunately, I don't have a lot to add. I can say that it seems to work in some areas pretty well and other areas not so well. There's quite a lot of cooperation going on for sea turtles, for example, and abalone. It's a struggle in other areas. We have the same challenges. What I'll do, Commissioner Rogers, is we have our Sustainable Fisheries Division folks who are directly involved in these trilateral negotiations. I'll do a little bit of research and get back to you on specific actions that are being underway to deal with the Mako and Thresher shark
issues. It might be helpful also for perhaps the commission to understand how the Mexicans are organized with respect to their fish and game activities and how we might, in perhaps even ourselves, even though we're only 3 mile people here, to do outreach or to attempt, because there's an obvious problem at the interface. San Diego is immediately adjacent to the border, and it is a huge fishing port for California anglers. Huge. I personally have fished out of there, you know, hundreds of times on short and long range tuna boats. It would be a wonderful thing if we could get together and cooperate and be on the same page. And the extent to which we can promote that would be a real net advantage, not only to the resources of the state of California and the pelagic resources that come by us, but also to the anglers, both commercial and recreational.
Absolutely.
The another side note: one of the difficulties is Mexico is currently reorganizing their government relative to the environment and natural resources. My impression from the discussions that may be of advantage to us, they're decentralizing. One of the issues in the past is they've been so centralized it's been hard to make contact. So my understanding is they're working on a system to kind of decentralize the authority so they'll be more regional.
So we might be able to get a Baja Commission,
for example. That's
we're
kind
doing
of
the deal.
Yeah, that's what it looks hopeful. So we can come back maybe with our federal counterparts and give you a more thorough update and something I think that's long overdue, actually.
Thank you all. Next speaker.
Next speaker, David Teasley, followed by Ken Jensen, followed by Jim Martin.
Thank you, sir.
I wanted to talk about this closure that was listed for Big Lake. I'm glad that most of you guys fished. That's a good thing. I think we need to protect bass. We came to Kenny Taylor, which is our local game warden, and talked to him about this kind of a unique area on these black bass. These black bass move into these warm water springs in the winter. We've sent some letters, and I hope maybe you guys got the information on it. Anyway, we know that they needed a little protection, so we talked to him, and he brought Larry Hansen on board. Everyone came up. We met with some other anglers and toured the sites, and I showed him what was going on. And this population of bass is in real good shape right now. What we're talking about is a potential for a problem in the future. And we got great spawning up there now. I work for PG&E up there, and a lot of rock's been introduced on these levees which surround the lake, and the spawning has been really booming since 1997 on the first levee break. Anyway, so these bass, like I said, we're trying to protect them. I've seen a lot of stuff today on this, close this, and this, close that. And I know you guys like to fish like I do. And I've written all these reasons why I think we could go to a catch and release system, which everybody was pretty much on board with this from the very start. We were led to believe that the commission always likes to keep things open if possible. And anywhere from enforcement right on down to the last stage of this thing, we think it can be done with the catch and release system. You'll still protect the bass. And as far as now they're starting to talk about, well, a river system interferes with this, and that can be defined like any other river. And where the black bass migrate to, it really has no bearing on the river. You could wordage a closed area for black bass. But anyway, I feel like a catch and release system would be far better if we keep taking away these these people that came forward here to protect these fish, you know, these are all you guys' allies, and a lot of people are looking at this up here in the North State, and there's a lot of other lakes that I really want to work on with you guys, and we're going to see how this goes, and I don't want to lose all these guys. Like I said, I'm speaking for myself, but I don't want to lose these people because we got a lot of good ideas on these lakes. A black bass fishery on these smaller lakes are really in jeopardy. And I know times are changing, and we're going to have to change a few things. I fish a lot of states and fish a lot of catch and release lakes, and they're the most terrific lakes you'd ever want to fish. I could go right down the line. But anyway, I'll cut this off.
Thank you. Me again, if I may. Department have a comment on that? Or are they gone?
Department's missing. Oh, here
no.
he comes.
No, he isn't. There's Neil.
Or, yes.
Thank you. I've asked Larry Hansen, who's a senior biologist from Northern California, North Coast region, is very familiar with that area, to speak on that, because Larry has been in communication with the angling groups up there, and I've asked Larry to provide the comments for the department.
Great.
Thank you.
Morning, commissioners. As David elaborated, we have a unique situation in Big Lake. It's a series of artesian springs that enter the lake in the Ajamawi Lava Springs State Park. And in the winter, the water flowing from the springs is roughly 6 to 8 degrees warmer than the ambient water temperature in Big Lake. We have a very large migration of largemouth bass that move into the springs, and they stack in there, essentially. They stack in there large. There's been a misinterpretation within the current regulation, as Neil mentioned earlier. Under Section 5 of the Special Black Bass Fishing Regulations, you can interpret that regulation to read that Big Lake is open all year with a limit of 5 bass, 12 inches or larger. However, under Section 5.7.5.4b, the waters of Fall River Valley are closed to the take of trout to protect the trout stocks of that blue ribbon trout stream, wild trout stream. And because of the fact that it's closed to the take of trout, it's also closed to all fishing. David and three other individuals, through the help of Warden Ken Taylor, drew my attention to the issue, and essentially their stance was that they wanted to afford protection to the bass that use the spring during the winter months in order to protect them from over-harvest, because they are very vulnerable. And they took us out to the site, and to prove the point, they managed to land some bass up to about 5 pounds within a half an hour. So this is an area that is an incredible fishery. Crystalline waters, artesian springs, next to a very, basically, at that time of the year, fairly turbid watershed.
So. Commissioner Kellogg, do you smell a field trip? 5 pounds. Is the group who's... Thank you. Is the group who's talking about, and yourselves, who are talking about catch and release, willing to go barbless, for example?
From what I can tell, the group was essentially just interested in preserving the resource. They wanted to have the opportunity to fish, but they wanted to limit the harvest. Mm-hmm. They came to me with a couple different options, one of which was a catch and release option. The other, they said, basically, they weren't entirely in favor of it, however, but if it took a closure right. to the fishery, that we really need to protect the fishery. And again, it's a seasonal closure based on the trout closures.
Because mortality is, you know, the mortality issue is dramatically improved mm-hmm. when you go barbless. Right.
Even worst case
release.
Scenario, 10%.
Yeah. I mean, it's, and I think worst case scenario is that 10% is overinflated, but that's my own.
You know, especially with the fish as hardy as largemouth bass, I would agree with
right. you. Right. Good. So barbless would be a component, perhaps, of this. Okay. Very good. It was good thinking. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. Actually, Ken Jensen was the next speaker I had called. And then Jim.
John, could I switch with Jim DeMartini? Because he's going to present.
You want him first?
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead, Ken.
Good Executive Director John Carlson and Vice President Bob Atoy and other commission members. My name is Ken Jensen. I'm here representing an 85-member fly club, Merced, California. And we're also indirectly represented, I feel, a lot of anglers in the Central Valleys, the Central Valley down there, and Central San Joaquin Valley. We are requesting your help in restoring a sport fishery on the lower Merced River that was destroyed in 1985. And we appeared before the commission after we did 4 years of study after 1985 when Director Hal Cribbs was here. And, we appeared before the commission when that fishery was destroyed 4 years later after after doing a lot of study and a lot of work out there. And when we presented, the commission directed the Department of Fish and Game to restore the fishery. The attempt to restore the fishery in 1990 was spectacularly unsuccessful. I was going to wait until we could throw that first slide up for just a minute. He's just about to get it. But
are you technically challenged, Steve?
Hey, I talked to him. He's a genius, and I'm really challenged. So
What destroyed the fishery?
A regulation change. I opened the river up to a January 1st opening, which was fine. Left a 5-fish limit on it. It had a fabulous rainbow fishery in it. Fish averaged 11 to 15 inches with numbers of fish between 17 and 24 inches in there. And we really opposed the regulation change because it also opened up predation on out-migrant smolts from the king fishery that's in there. So recently the change has come back a little. They put a catch and release on it. So now the river, if we could restore the fishery, we could have a great fishery in that river. But anyway, it's not only a rainbow, but it's also a steelhead restoration proposal. Ours is the rainbow end, but the department has proposed a steelhead restoration proposal on the river, too, in our meetings in December of 2005. Now, there are probably 1 million people within 80 miles of this 10-mile reach of the river. And it's this is the last dam on the river. It's the 10 miles below this reach. And these rivers in the Central San Joaquin Valley, unlike I think our coastal streams, can support a multi-species fishery, a recreational fishery. Because what we have now is a 2-week king fishery in that river. It's full of suckers, squawfish, hardheads, and carp. Although the temperature we have 5 years of temperature studies on that river. And I'm asking, because of the limitations on time, John Fisher recommended that we get some time at your Reading meeting, except the second and third, and get on the agenda for approximately 12 to 13 minutes.
Sure. Listen, and 85 guys sent you down here, so go ahead for a little while more today, and also you'll have 3 more chances before you make a decision.
Excuse me, sir, I didn't quite...
I said, since 85 guys sent you down here today, feel free to go for a few more minutes, and you also have 3 more chances before December when we make a decision. So tell us your most important points today, and then we'll give you some more time at the future meetings. You know.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Not too much longer, but feel free to make some points.
If I could get about 12 to 13 minutes, it'd be perfect. That was the formal request that we get on the agenda.
Might not be
the Reading
perfect, but
meeting,
go ahead. Okay.
Because I love that Reading area, because it has a multi-species managed rainbow fishery mixed with salmon. Yeah. And your commission policy is what I'd like to really address. Not only the history of what happened to that river, which takes 3 or 4 minutes, but the commission policy, which said no residential fishery shall be established in an anadromous stream unless, in the opinion of the Department of Fish and Game, it will not have a significant effect on the anadromous fish. That would be steelhead and salmon. Okay. That's the commission policy, and that's the commission policy plus temperature problems that the department has basically utilized over the last 20 years. To really not look seriously at that fishery, and try to restore it. We don't think that rainbows, who have historically lived with salmon all over the United States of America, we don't think that rainbows have a significant effect on salmon populations. We do think that the salmon population in the Merced, and we do, as I mentioned, have a 2-week salmon fishery on the Merced, catch and release, barbless only. Those fish come a long way, and they're pretty beat up, so it's not really much of a fishery. That's what we've got right now. But we do think that rainbows have historically lived with these, with salmon and steelhead all over the western coast of California, Washington, Alaska, period. Everything's already been there. Well, that fishery in the Sacramento River is multi-species, managed well, and it provides huge economic benefits for the people who live in that area. We could do the same in all these lower rivers. The Tuolumne has a year-round rainbow fishery in there, a self-sustaining population. The Merced has absolutely no gravels between 1/4 inch and 2.5 inches, which are necessary to have a self-sustaining population. We're willing to get those gravels as a club. The rainbow suggestions that we have in here, the suggestions and the options we have developed, will cost the state of California and the Department of Fish and Game nothing. We've developed two proposals that we think will work really well, and with the combination and having a balanced fishery with the Department of Fish and Game, interested in beginning a steelhead restoration program tied in with NIMS, and I'm going to the meeting on the 17th with NIMS, because they're going, although they've designated our river as critical habitat, they've never written a restoration proposal. In fact, they've designated rivers all over the state as critical steelhead habitat, never written a restoration proposal. Well, they're on their way now. And the department, I've talked to them in Region 4 because we love to work with our department. We've done a lot for the department. The reason the river is posted now with 12 beautiful signs that limit, that state the regulations, is because the club paid for it. We've added gravels on that river below their salmon reach at our expense. And we've worked strongly with the Department of Fish and Game over the years. But we really believe that the people who live in that area deserve a recreational sport fishery. And whether or not the department regulation can be overcome, or the commission regulation can be overcome by the department saying, yeah, they won't affect the population of salmon and steelhead in that river, if there were any steelhead of any significance, and there are not. There's no data to support it. We hope there will be. We really support that element, but we like a balanced fishery in there with rainbows and steelhead, and a fishery that would be available to the people, because a major predator on that river doesn't happen to be rainbows, as there are none, and I don't think they'd ever would be rainbows, because they had 25,000 kings come back in 1976 on that river. 25,000 came back right at the height when there was a beautiful rainbow fishery in there. Didn't seem to have any effect. The real predator on that river is that pike minnow or the Sacramento squawfish and the Clifton Court pumping stations in the Delta. Those are the predators. And so it seems rather illogical to me to deprive a lot of people of what was once an excellent fishery just on the basis of, well, the rainbows may predate some of those salmon. In general, they seem to me they'd more predate the fry of the pike minnow and put some natural controls on the rough fish that fill that river. So anyway, I would like a little time to give you a little more history, go over the commission's policies, talk about the three major issues that the department has kind of used to not really take a close look at it. I think we have four recommendations for action by the commission, and we'd love to get those in. And if I could get some time in ready, and I really appreciate it.
Why don't you just give us the four recommendations right now?
Oh, you will like them?
Yeah, while you're on the microphone.
Do you want me to give you this material right now?
Well, yes. Yeah. What I would like to do is this.
Okay.
Obviously, this public-private partnership that you're working on to restore
a
fishery is something that we're very interested in. Obviously, though, we have some rules, so
yes.
I'm not trying to discuss them, dismiss them, but I don't... Just what I'd like to hear is your main points as quickly as possible, but then I would like to receive your information, which we haven't yet. Make sure you work with Region 4. Make sure you work with Neil or Sankey or whoever you're working with, and you'll have three more chances to put your point of view before us before we make a decision in December. So I'll give you another 3-4 minutes maybe and make your 4 points. I want to know what the hell you want us to do, okay?
Well, how would you like to know what the hell we want to do?
Let's go do it.
First.
Let's do it. Four minutes to find out what the hell we want to do.
We'll give you our proposals, okay? And by the way, and working with the Department of Fish and Game in Fresno, California, Bill Loudermilk and I were on the Salmon and Steelhead Advisory Committee for many years, And I know it's Bill's call down there, and he hasn't made the call. We went down and worked with Dale Mitchell at Region 4, and Dale said, hey, we can put salmon, we can put steelhead in there, raised in Merced River waters from eggs. And he said, we can do that within a year. And I said, well, now look, it's interesting that we're talking to you. We have the notes on the meeting. Please give us a call in a month and let us know what happened. Well, we've been ignored. We've been ignored by the department for a month, even though I made some phone contacts and sent a letter requesting a little more information. So we felt we were kind of ignored, and that's one of the main reasons why we're here, because if we'd have worked with the department in a positive manner all the time like we have in the past, we wouldn't have to be here. Okay, here's our proposal. And
just four quick points.
Okay.
And we'll look at it more in depth later.
Okay, would you run that down a little more, please? And I'll get you your... Okay, there we go. Proposal one, rescue and restoration. This is the outlet canal above the last dam on the Merced River. Every year in that outlet canal, when the water goes down, we strand wild rainbow trout. Every year, when that canal goes down, we strand wild rainbow trout. And there's a niche fishery above this which has rainbows between, between 6 inches and 10 pounds.
That's okay. Just go to your point.
Okay. Well, we rescue these fish, and what we wanted to do with these fish is to move them over into the reach below the Crocker-Huffman Dam, the restoration reach. Okay. Because we feel that these fish, which could have some steelhead, because they've been there 45 or 50 years. In fact, there are people in Fish and Wildlife Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who are friends of mine, who say, look, you got a lot better chance taking a wild rainbow that's existed and survived on its own in a niche fishery for 20 years of going out to the ocean and coming back in its anadromous form. And there's no doubt that they Take said, you guys know that situation. Okay, so this is the first proposal, rescue wild fish, put them in the reach. Second proposal, please.
Good job, we're moving.
Oh, this is one of the wild rainbows from that reach. Next, move it on, please.
My God, it's a leopard.
Hey, there are red bands in there.
Wow.
The department has planted them for years, and the people who live along that two-mile stretch will not let anybody come in and get those fisheries. That's why it's been there for 45 or 50 years. Hit that again, please. Calaveras Trout Farm, which is Tim Goodson, one of the biggest trout farms in the state of California. He will grow for nothing, at his cost, with our help, 3,000-foot-long rainbow trout grown from eggs from Trout Lodge in the state of Washington, the number one source of disease-free rainbow eggs in the world, and the department uses them in California. And those 3,000-foot-long rainbow trout can be placed in
that
this Merced River.
Big trout.
Look, we figure that...
A 3,000-foot-long trout?
One pound. Excuse me.
I'm glad you recognize that,
Richard.
You may be talking fast, but you're a little slow.
That is a hell of a trout when the world record is 42 pounds. But anyway... He will grow 3,000 trout for us, 1 pound apiece, and we will place them in the river. And that way we will provide a fishery. Now, the steelhead proposal is the department's.
Yeah.
And we agree with that. But we want balance. We just won't want a steelhead fishery. Don't steelhead just go out? Good. And so how long a fishery may we have? Some will residentialize. But we feel with the wild trout and with the Trout Lodge Corporation stocks, we can have one heck of a fishery in the Merced River, and it won't take very long to get there. The problem, again, is, thank you. I get that's our proposals, and the very last slide shows what we'd like you guys to do. If you could keep going for that, sir, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, Ken.
There we go.
Good job. Let me tell you, this sounds all very interesting, I'm interested. Obviously... Well, and we'll give you more, but not today. Yep. And I don't mean that as a disrespectful thing. Make sure we get your information. I would like to make sure that you're still in communication with the department. And you'll have, like I said, October, November, and we make a decision in December. And do we want to hear
just a
response from the department about what
this
is about?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Saki,
just...
Yeah, very quickly.
Yeah, very quickly. Thank you, sir.
There's, of course, another side to this issue. We could certainly, Neil could certainly work with the region.
Thank you, Ken.
To try and present an overview of the total situation. In terms of the subject at hand, the agenda item, I don't see any regulatory actions being proposed here, so I just want to clarify.
Sure.
So this is a non-regulatory request. Okay.
Sure. This is just 85 guys coming to us wanting a fishery restored. which is important. Okay, thank you, and we'll be talking more about it between now and...
I appreciate it. Thank you very, very much.
Sure. Thanks for coming down. Yeah.
Ken, you hang around for a few minutes yet, too?
Sure.
I'm over here.
Voice of God.
Hang around for a few minutes.
Maybe we should just put this as an agenda item on the next, you know, meeting, not as a regulatory, just to continue to hear what this is about. Is that what you'd like us to do?
Yes. Thank you.
A small little agenda item? Because it's not a regulation.
Right. I'm just thinking the August. You haven't gotten a notice.
No,
October
and Reading.
I meant October.
You were suggesting Reading.
Yeah, just
sorry,
so we
I was thinking August. You said
agenda
August.
No.
You're not doing anything between now and August, right?
No, I meant October meeting. Thank you. No. Okay.
Thanks. Our next speaker, you want Jim Martini.
D. Martini,
followed by Jim Martin.
Commissioner, staff, I'm Jim D. Martini. I'm from Cloverdale. And I'm here today representing 150 or so very loosely organized crab fishermen from Bodega Bay, affectionately known as the fish heads. And I wanted to address you about what we believe to be an anomaly in the law that is really an issue of fairness. We will, beginning in November when the crab season, when the recreational crab season starts, prepare our crab pots, purchase $150 crab pots, outfit them with everything you need, bait them, drive our boats out into Bodega Bay, and put them out, and historically, as you catch crab, let them soak for a while. Well, while a commercial crabber can do that and feel comfortable that he'll go back to his pots and take his harvest, the Fish and Game Code doesn't provide that kind of protection for the recreational angler. In fact, anybody who wants to go out to my crab pot while I'm back in Bodega Bay waiting for my bait to soak can pull my crab pot, dump the crab out, throw the crab back, and walk away with impunity because it's just not against the law. We've worked with local law enforcement, the sheriff, and Fish and Game, and they've said, look, Jim, unless you get a change in 29.80 and 29.85 of the regulations, we're not going to help you. And the reason, what precipitated my being here today, we started these discussions back in October. The level of animosity that's engendered by this kind of behavior, criminal behavior we think, but obviously not criminal, is tremendous in Bodega Bay and to a lesser extent Half Moon Bay and Fort Bragg. There have been some fisticuffs. There are people that are incredibly mad at each other for this behavior. We've watched them do it with impunity. It's driven most of us nuts, to be honest with you. So I have proposed, and I sent you a letter. I hope you have it in your pack. Regretfully, I didn't bring copies today. My cover letter, I think, sets out our position. And it simply says, look, if you will mark your crab buoys appropriately with your first initial and last name, and we took this from the Washington statute, and we worked real hard with the local fish and game folks in Bodega Bay and the constituent groups, and I've worked with Jim Martin and a number of other groups. If you will mark your buoy like that, it will be a crime if somebody else pulls it. And we've included provision that if you want somebody to pull your pots for you, just give them written permission. And I wanted to modify the one thing in my draft proposal that, in consultation with Jim just this week, he pointed out, and I think it's highly appropriate, and I'd like to amend it, that we don't want to make not painting your buoys criminal. Somebody comes over from the valley and wants to throw out a crab pot. It should not be a crime if he doesn't mark his crab buoy with the way we've described. He's not going to have the protection, obviously, that the proposal would afford him. And I can redraft that and send it to staff later. I've added a section I to it that would make it clear that you don't have to mark your boys if you don't want to. I'm available for questions. I know Mr. Martin wanted to discuss this as well.
I guess I'm not sure it's either for you or the department, but when I first heard about through your letter and obviously through your testimony now, I keep thinking, how could that be?
That's
how
what everybody can, you know, asks.
Well, I'm just asking. I'm thinking to me, as I learned when I was growing up, you can't take something that's not yours. It's called stealing. My mom taught me that was wrong. But I'm wondering whether it's an enforcement issue, whether, you know. So I'd like the department just to, you know, let me know why we can let people steal people's crab pots. Seems wrong.
No, stealing crab pots is illegal.
I know, but I meant the crabs within the pots, which is... Go ahead.
Good morning, Commissioners. The nuance here is, first off, I have to say it's a sad day that we have anglers stealing each other's stuff.
Sure.
Unfortunately, it is going on.
Every day.
It is clearly a problem. The unique situation here is that the crabs don't belong to individuals until they're in your hand. So that's the loophole. As the gentleman pointed out, you can't take their trap, but the crabs don't belong to them until they land them. So we've been looking at this, and you know my mantra that I want to keep regulations simple. The department does not want to become the registry of crab float buoys. So we've looked at this and debated it extensively, and I think the most parsimonious solution, and the one we will be recommending, is simply adding language in that text that it will be illegal to pull or remove crabs out of a pot that doesn't belong to you.
Right.
And then it's up to the individual fishermen to decide whether they want to mark their buoys or not. It puts the onus on the individual fishermen, because there are places on the coast where, thankfully, people still respect each other's fishing property, so to speak, and don't do that. But we do have areas, and unfortunately, this practice has become somewhat frightfully normal. So that simple language change, we've been working with enforcement, will probably solve or allow enforcement to prosecute people who are doing that.
That's an enforcement issue. If that's the way the department wants to, we have no truck with that.
Because you're right. We don't want to have a registry of crab pot owners. But
the way we drafted it just said, hey, look, your information on your buoy better match your license.
It just seems to me if we make it illegal to take crabs in someone else's pot, I mean, I understand the technicality is that it's not yours until you land it. But to me, it's yours if it's in your pot.
Or even touch the gear.
Disturbing is what we talked about. Yeah. That's from the water.
Even picking up that buoy is illegal.
Let's work that out. Yeah, that'd be great.
Thank you for your attention.
Yeah, I am immensely sympathetic.
If you guys are successful in working that out, then I need you in Oakland and tell people it's illegal to shoot somebody.
Okay.
And you can work that one out.
We'll be going to the Middle East
Is there a problem with that in Oakland?
We'll be on our way to Lebanon after we solve the crab pot problem. We have grandiose plans for the commission.
I think it's really an important thing to do, but not only to solve their problem, but to do a little bit about the problem. I mean, every little tiny bit we can do on this problem is a good one. There are a lot of commercial fishermen who believe they own the fish, and that every recreational fish that is taken is their fish. That is complete wrong. And your crabs that you catch legally and correctly are absolutely yours. They do not belong to the commercial fishermen. There are guys down in San Diego, we were just talking about this, who establish a chum line, commercial boats, you know, out there are party boats or even, you know, whatnot. And if a recreational fishing boat comes within 500 yards of their boat, they harass them with profanity, with all kinds of amazing things. These guys need to be chased off the water themselves. And this commission, whatever we can do to solve this problem of commercial guys thinking they own the fish, we need to solve that problem.
For the record, we have no beef with the commercial industry. There's no evidence that it's the commercial.
Well, you need to say that. I need to say what I just did.
Sure. And okay.
Can I correct one thing, Commissioner Rogers? I don't know that it's a lot of commercial fishermen, but there's a few bad apples in any population.
It is not the majority of the commercial fishermen,
right,
but they do it virtually every day, and I personally have seen it almost every day.
Sankey, please.
Yeah, I just wanted, just so we're not promising a panacea here, this rule change will not solve thievery.
Of course.
I mean, the commercial guys, just for reference, the commercial lobster fishermen, which currently have provisions where it's illegal to pull another commercial fisherman's pot, they have routine thievery going on in their traps.
That was my whole point, Sankey, when I mentioned
exactly. I know that's what you're after. This isn't a panacea. It will help where we have local problems, you know, not that we got a lot of wardens go chasing around people pulling pots, but it would help in some situations where at least you could enforce it.
Well, right.
Do you know?
I'm not trying to say that we can change human behavior here. I'm not that delusional. I'm saying we can at least make it wrong so that someone can say to someone else, that's no longer legal what you're doing. You know, that's all I'm trying to say.
When we started this,
people still break the speed limit, you know?
I assured Fish and Game that if they gave me the tools, if it became illegal, I'm a practicing attorney, and I've explained to my friends that I can enforce it civilly. Right, you say it's wrong. I don't need the department on every instance. But right. if I see someone doing it, I can be in small claims court immediately. And that whoever's doing that is going to have a real problem
exactly.
with me.
Right. Okay. Let's not steal is what we're trying to say. Okay.
Thou shalt not.
Thou shalt not, says Vice President Hatchway. Go ahead, Jim.
Thank you. My name is Jim Martin. I'm with the Recreational Fishing Alliance, and I'd like to support Jim DeMartini's proposal. I think it's a public safety issue above yeah. all. The complaints that we're getting from our members who crab and the problem of having nowhere to go with this problem. You find somebody pulling your pots. What do I do? Short of shoot them or throw a rock at them? Or
thou shall not shoot. Thou shall not shoot.
I run into too. Other yeah, okay. Ten Commandments. Yes.
So. No, come on, Jim. You have to go to Oakland to do that, right?
Let's behave. But you're right. We just need a mechanism in which to enforce either civilly or just to say, yeah, hey, stop, it's illegal.
We'll try to keep it as simple as possible. On other crab regulation changes, I think that the Golden Gate Fishermen's Association is proposing consistent limits for charter operations and private boaters. There's now a 6 crab limit on charter boats, 10 on private boats, and there's also a size difference. We'd like to make that the same for everybody, just to keep the regulations simple, and I think that's consistent with what Sankey's asking for in terms of simple regulations.
Sankey?
Yes, on this one, I would request that I get a majority vote because the commission originally made this deal. Those of you, I don't remember who was on the commission when we did this. This was a new thing. The charter boats wanted to start offering the service, and it was very controversial, so they negotiated this compromise, which was a lower number, a crab limit, and a larger crab to kind of settle some ill feelings about having the charter boat recreational fleet compete with the straight recreational guys in their own boats. If you want to change that, that's fine. I just want to make sure because I need you to give me direction
to
do
that. I'm a little nervous about going there. We put an awful lot of thought into that. Yeah, we had hearings and people were very, I mean, thank you for the suggestion. Personally, I would like to just hold that thought for a minute. The idea of making it illegal to take people's crabs is one thing. The idea of opening up the whole crab regulatory issue, given what we went through, as Sankey just explained, even if you might think it's a good idea, and it just worries me. I'm not wanting to jump on that so quickly.
Was Commissioner Flores on the commission at the time?
I think he was, because I was. So.
Jim, do you remember? I don't remember when that was.
I don't even remember it, but it's not a resource issue. And who had the problem with it? Commercial?
Marcy and Maria might remember this.
Because I was
six
not.
Years ago. Then I wasn't on it, but I heard a lot of crap about it.
Yeah.
I
like simplifying and consistent regulations. Don't get me wrong. It just, this was a very controversial issue getting it here. It just, this is going to be a lot of work for us to consider. And if you want us to do that, I would respectfully ask that you vote and tell me to add this to the package.
I would suggest that we put it into the Marine Resources Subcommittee as something we can look at in our matrix of priorities, and then we'll get back to the full commission on that. Is that okay with you?
That's fine. Yeah,
thank
I
you.
Just wanted to speak in support of that one.
No,
and the
thanks.
Final point I wanted to make on albacore bag limits, we're supportive of them. We do have questions about in the north, people are interested in a higher bag limit because we cannot get out that far to access them every year, or not even every 5 years. Sometimes it's once every 10 years we can access albacore in ports like Fort Bragg, Eureka, Crescent City. Oregon has a 25 fish bag limit, and in Fort Bragg where I live, people go down to the commercial docks with wheelbarrows and they have canning parties. And so with the expense of gas and the investment that you have to make to access 60 miles offshore, it's often a group event, and what we're worried about is as the International Treaty Authority ratchets down from 25, or if we start with what Bob Fletcher proposes, 5 albacore, it gives us nowhere to go. So we're a little concerned about that, what the future of the ratcheting down will be, and also just making it consistent with Oregon and Northern California.
Well, as you know, out there, very few were caught within 3 miles. I'm not even sure if any of them are.
Yeah.
You know, you got to haul way
I've
out.
I've actually caught an albacore inside 3 miles.
Have you really?
Fort Bragg. When it's good, it's good up there. But that was one day, and that was about 8 years ago. I have not caught an albacore since. So I'd like to be able to get as many as I need, up to 25. I don't want to waste them, but I can certainly use 25 if that's my trip for once in 10 years and I'm canning them.
We'll be looking all of that. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Our last speaker on this item is John Duffy.
Good morning, Vice President Hattoy and members of the Commission. I'm John Duffy, speaking today as an avid recreational skin diver, and perhaps a half a dozen of my cohorts have similar feelings. To provide the public with greater flexibility in summertime recreational diving activity, we request that you open the month of July to recreational abalone harvest. This closed month was established some 15 to 20 years ago as a means to limit effort and therefore harvest at a time when there was no annual harvest limit. We've gone from no annual harvest limit through a 100 annual harvest limit down to the current 24 annual limit. With this low level, or with this appropriate level of 24, there would be no change in the total take. It would just allow a greater period of activity. In addition, I've already submitted a written request that you increase the daily bag limit from 3 to 4 abalone. This will help provide relief to the inland living public from the ever-increasing cost of travel to and from the coastal area, again, without any threat of increasing the total take or any damage to the resource, because there'd be no change in the total annual harvest limit. Speaking of crab fishing, which I had not originally intended to address, but I might also request that you change the opening date to simply be November 1st from the current, I think it's the Saturday preceding the second Tuesday in November. That date relates historically to a time past when the commercial season opened by a certain second Tuesday date, but that commercial date has now been set to simply open November 15th in statute, so this would just provide a two-week lead time for the sport fishing. And finally, I had, in just in passing, during your discussion of the sturgeon regulations, I understood Neil to say that you could catch and release all the sturgeon you want, and I wondered if that meant that a person could continue to fish for sturgeon even after they have caught and retained their annual harvest limit of 3 fish. Just a question. Thank you.
Any comments? Or
does department have a response?
Mr. Duffy actually presented quite a few interesting things there. We'll have to look at some of those. The sturgeon question, our intent would not be to allow somebody to catch and release, because as you know, if you inadvertently harm a sturgeon to the point where you know it's not going to live, I would rather have them retain and tag a fish than throw it back to die. So our normal rules are you can't fish once you've retained a possession limit, either daily or seasonal. So I think, Rob, correct me, it'd be illegal to continue catch and release sturgeon fishing once you've used your last card or have retained one for the day. So
that
we would make that clear.
That's what I'm feeling it should be.
Yeah, so I thank him for pointing that out.
Great.
The abalone thing's intriguing. He makes a very good point that if there's a yearly limit, however, that is not without cost. The biggest one is enforcement. Right now, it would add additional enforcement workload, because now you'd have another month that they have to watch for bad guys. We'd have to look at that, but again, if the commission wants us to look at that, we'd respectfully ask that they take a majority vote, because it will be a fair amount of work to look at that question. It's an interesting one, though.
I think the way we've been handling this, when someone comes with a suggestion that's has merit, but it's not on our agenda. Maybe we can refer it once again to Marine Resources. And we'll look at that, and then if there's a examination.
As a correction, this is the meeting that the public can make recommendations for sport fish.
Oh, so I get it, to add to the sport fishing reg. That's,
yeah, it's
that's
just a matter of, does the commission want us to formally consider that in terms of drafting a regulatory option or not?
Well, yeah. Sankey, correct me if I'm wrong. Since you've just received this, you still now have to analyze and
bring back a reason.
That's what I need to have.
To either accept or reject. You don't need the commission's permission for
if
that.
If I can get you to cull some of these now.
No, no, no. But this is the public recommendations on the analysis by the department for the sport fishing reg.
Well, Sankey, so I think the issue of cost is the only rationale for why we, and you probably don't have that number in your head.
No, it's
so
premature.
So we need you to come back with that number.
What about crab?
We have three more months.
What about crab?
The crab season, we'll look at that. That's actually, the more I can simplify opening dates,
I love
better.
That idea.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
I like that, because we've been cleaning those up over the years anyways.
Yeah.
Cool.
Thank you, John.
But I worry about that diving in the summer months with that withering syndrome.
Mr. Wheatland, your time is up. Our next agenda.
I have a suggested motion.
Oh, yes.
If there's no more discussion by the commission,
go ahead on that.
Go ahead on that, please.
That the Fish and Game Commission hereby authorizes its staff to publish notice of its intent to amend the sport fishing regulations for 2007 to 2009.
So moved.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? No. Okay. That's been going to notice.
Thank you.
Item 17.
Item 17, please.
Item 17, request to publish notice of commission intent to amend the recreational groundfish regulations for 2007-2008 and department update on the management measures adopted by the PFMC at its June 11th to 16th, 2006 meeting. Note, the discussion hearing is scheduled for August 25th, 06 in Santa Barbara on this issue.
Good morning, Commissioners. Maria Vojkovic with the Marine Region, and the person who attends all the Pacific Fishery Management Council meetings. The council just completed its...
Give me 1 second. Folks, Maria's got the microphone. Please take your conversations outside. Thank you, Maria. Please continue.
Sure. The council just completed its biennial groundfish management cycle in June, and the package that was adopted for recreational angling was probably the most generous that we've seen in the last few years, actually in the last probably 4 years. So the council was able to provide the maximum fishing opportunities for groundfish in California than it's seen recently. Thinking of what Commissioner Rogers said about handing regulations to someone who doesn't know what's going on, we have taken that to heart, and Sankey's harping at us about clarifying regulations. So this package for groundfish contains significant changes to organize and clarify and simplify the groundfish regulations for the public. When we give those regulation changes to you, you can look at them and see whether you understand them now.
Would be the first time.
Yes. It's been very difficult. The council chose to increase the greenling bag limit to 2 within the rockfish cabazon and greenling bag limit of 10. So out of 10 of those fish, 2 can now be greenling, whereas it used to be 1. The council also adopted a 12-month California scorpion fish season for Southern California. That season, I believe, had been restricted to something like 6 months. We had a stock assessment that showed the stock to be extremely healthy, so we've offered a 12-month season. In general, the changes to seasons, open seasons, and water depth were increased in all portions of the state except the far north. The far north had pretty much the most generous for the kind of fishing species, this kind of species that are available for the anglers in that area. So some of the opportunities have increased from up to 10 months of fishing for groundfish in the south, and I think the least amount was 6 months of fishing in the north central coast off of San Francisco area, but they've been increased water depth out to 30 fathoms, so that their access of the shelf species of rockfish has, they do have that access, or will have that access. The one item that I want to draw your attention to that we've provided for in the recreational changes are the option to rescind the shore-based and the diver exemption for when the groundfish seasons are closed. Currently, the divers and shore-based anglers can continue fishing. We've provided the commission with the option for simplification of regulations and enforcement applicability to make everything the same. When groundfish is closed, everybody's closed. So you have that option within your package. When you when it comes up for adoption, we would be asking specifically for you to make the decision as to whether you want to leave it as status quo or change it. That's about it. What's contained in that package? If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them, but we've increased fishing opportunities for 07 and 08 while still maintaining the need to meet our overfished rockfish OYs and our other species OYs.
What a difference a year makes, huh?
Yeah. I mean, that's the part I find exciting, that we had this crisis, but the examination of the science showed that we could increase fishing opportunities.
It's a couple of items. It's increased information on stocks.
Yep.
It's also a better data collection system that we have through our SURFS program.
Right.
And I must say that the angling public involved in these public meetings leading up to this have been very helpful in trying to help us create simpler regulations and yet meet their needs too.
Speaking to that point, Maria, this doesn't relate to what you've just been talking about, but it does in sort of a oblique way. On Wednesday, we heard a lot about from certain interests about the area south of Monterey, all the way down to Point Conception, being in its most robust fishery in 30 years. You probably picked up on those commentary. To most of us, that was anecdotal. You know, we're not comfortable with hearing anecdotal information and then operating on it. To what extent is your feeling, and I realize it may be anecdotal, but informed anecdotal, about what's going on in those areas where they're fundamentally wild in the sense that there aren't a whole bunch of fishing opportunities there because people, you know, the weather does a pretty good job keeping them remote. What's your sense of all that? What's going on from, say, Conception up to, Monterey Peninsula?
Well, I can't give you
nothing specific
sense biologically of what's going on. I will say that some of the people that you heard from have been doing some research on their own, collecting data about that area. And the marine region is discussing the data, the collection methods, how we might be able to use that information to inform our decisions, because it appears that they do have information that we don't. And so how do we go about using that? So we have been contacted, and I know that Gary is committed to meeting with those people and starting the dialogue of what data do you have and how can we use that?
I mean, we all understand that ultimately, once the MPA network gets in place from Conception up and ultimately all the way up and down the coast, that we'll have much more information because we'll have the monitoring, and, you know, because we're not going to do it if we don't. We'll have the monitoring, we'll have the enforcement, and we'll be able to have much better data on all of that. So, I mean, I realize that we're at sort of in our infancy, but I was just wondering what your sense of the veracity, if you will, of some of these claims. Not making any judgments yourself or in the sense of trying to underwrite anyone else's commentary, but is it your sense that the fishery is as robust, or at least going in the direction of robustness that we are hearing a lot about?
I think that appearance, what people are seeing, is not just taking place in that one specific area. We've heard those same kind of comments along the entire Pacific coast.
Interesting.
So
you're thinking very large ecological changes involved here, of a pelagic almost nature.
The other states have seen increases in some of the species they haven't seen for several years, and they're not just baby fish. They're pretty good-sized fish. This past year, we had very large catches of blue rockfish in both California and Oregon that we haven't seen for several years.
Is this an upwelling issue?
It's probably a lot to do with climate, current changes, food web changes over the last few years. El Nino, the succession of El Ninos we had in the past, and now we haven't had any for several years. Things are gotten a little bit back to normal.
Interesting.
Richard, this is really pretty cool what she's sharing with us, because there's a lot of people throughout the whole Channel Island fiasco and everything else that really engage in us getting a better data collection system and stuff like that. Some, like Randy Fry, who fought really hard for that, would love to have been around to hear the results of what we're hearing today.
Yeah. That's well said, Jim. I agree. You know, and my experience is all entirely anecdotal. I'm out in the Channel Islands almost every weekend. I will be on Saturday. I will be tomorrow. And, it's my experience, too, what you're saying. There's some profound things, but I'm just an anecdotal observer.
Yeah, and it depends on what species you're talking about.
Absolutely. It's very species specific.
Right.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.
Commissioners, we have no public speaker cards on this issue, but I do have a suggested motion.
Move the department's recommendation.
Second.
Well,
for go to notice.
Motion is
that we go to notice.
Yeah, authorize the staff to publish notice of intent to amend recreational ground fish regulations.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
I'm so sorry. We're actually having a discussion on an important issue.
Well, you just voted.
Thank you very much. I'm so glad that people fill in. Democracy.
You just voted
works.
To conduct the rest of the meeting without your glasses on.
Really?
Yeah.
God, I see it the same way.
There we are.
I'm still
item
confused.
18.
Item 18, please.
Item 18, receipt of public testimony on proposed amendments to sections 163 and 164, Title 14. Regarding commercial herring fishery and harvesting of herring eggs on kelp. Please note that the adoption hearing is scheduled for October 6th in San Diego. Department, Sankey?
Yeah, commissioners, we have reviewed all the proposals. It's a good news story in terms of the resource, and the department is, as we understand it, accommodating pretty much every request we've had from the fishery this time around. It's in your packets. Unless you have specific questions, I wasn't going to drag you through the umpteen options and changes, but I will if you would like me to.
I don't think it's necessary. We know that one almost by heart.
Right. Thank you. We know the herring fishery.
I have one public speaker card for this issue, Sam Liberati.
Good morning. My name is Sam Liberati. I feel like I got a private conference here.
It wasn't that way on Wednesday, Sam.
Pardon?
It wasn't that way on Wednesday had you been here.
No, I'm sure. And I got to apologize before time. I don't have my hearing aids on again, so... But when you get to the mic, I could hear you well. The average amount of herring biomass in San Francisco Bay is 36,000 ton. A little over 100,000 ton biomass, I believe, was only three other times recorded, and that was one big season, or three big seasons. The number of spawn this year was 140,000 ton plus, 144. The biggest amount of biomass ever recorded in San Francisco Bay. Not bad for a fishery that some people tried to make you believe was depleted. Our quota for this coming season could be anywhere from 14 to 21,000 ton, going on the 10 or 15% allowed. The Herring Fishermen's Herring Advisory Committee, along with the biologists, decided on going for a quota of 4,500 ton to keep it the same as last year. And the reason being is that we feel that that would give us enough fish to make a decent season, the amount of boats that are fishing, and it would also allow more fish to spawn, which is good for everybody. Now I got to read from here because I got a lot of names here I don't want to forget. You commissioners are to be commended on your good judgment coming to the decisions you made to keep this fishery going. Special interest groups put a lot of pressure on trying to close the fishery down and stopping us from getting the correct mesh size. Speaking for the herrings, fishermen, we want to thank you for your consideration on our side of the problems to the fishery and for helping us get back on track with the biologists. You should be proud of this, and this should be an example for all the fisheries in California when a biologist and a fisherman can work together. I would like to thank Secretary of Resources Mike Chrisman. He's the first one that said that we've got to come together. I want to thank Jim Kellogg for carrying on with Mike when Mike left off. I want to thank the director, Ryan Broadruck, who I think has really been an asset to the state. I want to thank Zonke and Becky Oda, who helped get the relationship back on track where it belongs. Zonke, when he took over, he got into a hornet's nest. I'm sure he could tell you that. But he's proven to be a real good leader. And I think he'll be even better in the future. And Tom Moore. Tom Moore started this 2-inch thing in Bodega Bay. And I take my hat off to Tom and his crew because it's proven to be a real good thing. So I guess I've said all the thank yous, but we really do appreciate the consideration that you gave us. Only one other thing that I've got some calls on, a problem that we, I don't know if we're going to have or not, but we have in the past, and I think Zonke's aware of the regulations on nets, on lead lines, and cork lines. And if I could just take a minute to explain to you that on a gill net, when it's hung, the cork line is hung to fish in a particular way that you want it to fish, if you want to hang your net in or out or whatever. The lead line is hung to the cork line. For example, if you take 6 hangers or 8 hangers or whatever, you have to have at least one hanger slack in the lead line. You put a lot of lead in the net today because years ago we had plastic floats, made a lot of noise. We're getting a lot of complaints from Sausalito and the flotation wasn't that great anyway, so we went to Spunjack Corks. Now, Spunjack has a lot more flotation, so we started adding more lead on the net because the net has to sink to the bottom. One of the fishermen in Zeke Grader, and I don't know if Zonke has done anything. I called him one day, and I never had a chance to get back to him. But in the regulations, they claim if you interpret it a certain way, when you have a long lead line, that makes the net a trammel net. Well, that's not true. That's strictly wrong. But it's in the regulations. I haven't really read it. But the enforcement says that when you hang a net in with a lot of slack, it creates a bag. It does not create a bag. It does the complete opposite. If you want to create a bag in a gill net, you have to make the lead line short. And that creates a sack. That's the way a purse seine or a round hauler works, by closing the bottom. So if you talk to some enforcement people, I mean, they're way off base there. But, of course, they're going by the book. For those that don't know, a trammel net is a three-panel net. And also on a gill net, the fish have to gill. Because even if there was some way for you to sack them up, you could not get them on the boat unless they're gilled. That's why we had all the problems with the mesh size. I'm going to talk to Zonke a little further on this. We had Zeke Rader and another fisherman were supposed to get it through the legislation to correct that, and evidently they didn't do it. But
Sam.
Pardon?
You have such a great relationship with the department and the biologists and everybody now. I think that this is not something you can't work through.
Well, that's what I've been telling the fishermen, but some guys are real concerned that, geez, a guy could write us a ticket for this. And I just want to bring it to your attention so you were aware, because if some poor guy gets stuck and comes before you for a trammel net, I mean, you know, everything is going real good now, and I want to see it stay this way. So I just thought I'd bring that up. And like I say, I want to talk to Zonke a little bit later and see if any improvements have been made. And again, I thank you guys. I know you guys went against the grind. I know what Jim Kellogg went through and all the bad press and everything. But I think you guys should be pretty proud because you did the right thing. And you didn't let nobody point you in the wrong direction. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Sam.
But lately, excuse Jim me, Kellogg's been getting good press, so he's in good shape.
Well, going off of what Jim said, I mean, I think one of the great strengths of what's going on right now is the relationship between the department and the herring fishermen. And I don't think the commission wants to get in the middle of that. You guys are doing a wonderful job communicating with each other and should continue to do so.
Yep. And that's what we want to thank you for.
And just for background information, the staff has received some letters regarding trammel nets and lead lines versus float lines. Those have been referred to the department's enforcement staff. There is dialogue going on about that. And, you know, I don't know if enforcement has anything to add to that right now, but there is dialogue going on about that, and I think that can move towards a solution there.
Thank you. I think next item is the consent calendar, and we don't have any speakers to pull any items to oppose it, so I guess
I move the consent calendar.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The ayes have it.
Thank you.
And our final item is the announcement of our next meetings.
Our next, we will have a special hearing on August 15th in Monterey, focusing on MPAs for the Central Coast. And then we will be in Santa Barbara on August 24th and 25th.
Maybe only the 24th?
No, it looks like it will be both.
We will have information.
Yes, we will have information. We will be on both those days, and the agenda will be posted for that next week. Then October 5th and 6th in San Diego.
A question for the department, if I may. Is Nancy going to be available for the 15th?
She should be done backpacking by then, yes.
No, the question is not security. The question was enforcement.
As in
As in MPAs.
Yeah, yeah, we will have, if not Nancy's...
someone to speak very specifically to the questions.
Tony Warrington, who was here the last two days, he is our specialist, if you will, focused strictly on marine enforcement issues. So it, in the very least, it'll be Tony or Nancy.
But as you're well aware, a lot of logic is going to revolve around that. So being specifically prepared to discuss those issues and differentiations between packages would be very useful.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, and I guess we need a motion to adjourn.
So move.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
We busted out before 11.
All right.
Free at last.
Is Mr. Hathaway?